Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, much reporting on the White House's new budget proposal focuses on tax increases, military cuts, and how the budget will affect the national debt. But what's the whole story on the White House budget? We'll hear from Ruth Flower from the Friends Committee on National Legislation about the five things your newspaper might not tell you about the budget. Also on Counterspin, 1 year ago saw a massive uprising against Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's attack on public sector workers. That citizen movement posed a direct challenge to media narratives about issues like labor unions and budget austerity. John Nichols of The Nation looks at the Wisconsin story in his new book, Uprising. He'll join us to talk about it. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
Are government budgets the same as family budgets? That analogy is frequently put forth with the attendant lesson that, in tough times, governments, just like family households, need to tighten their belts. On February 13th, ABC World News anchor Diane Sawyer raised the analogy in discussing the new White House budget. Quote, "What does this budget have in common with the kind of family budget Americans wrestle with around the kitchen table?" Close quote. Correspondent Jake Tapper answered, explaining that if you just take a lot of zeros off the federal budget, it's much the same as a family budget, and government shortfalls much the same as family debt. The piece included a soundbite from White House Press Secretary Jay Carney, who was followed by Republican Senator John Barrasso, denouncing the White House plan and thus bolstering ABC's premise. But the analogy is not only false, it's actually dangerous. In the New York Times column last July by economist Paul Krugman, he called the analogy one of the right's favorite economic fallacies, writing, quote, "No, the government shouldn't budget the way families do. On the contrary, trying to balance the budget in times of economic distress is a recipe for deepening the slump," close quote. As others have noted, families can't issue their own currency, and wage earners can't decide to give themselves a raise, which the federal government can do in the form of taxation. But none of this has stopped conservatives from raising the family analogy to sound the alarm about spending and argue for government belt tightening. Conservatives and ABC News, which for some reason chose to cover the budget debate through the prism of a false analogy that helps bolster the Republican case against the White House.
The New York Times seldom misses a chance to advance U.S. propaganda demonizing Iran, and that was obvious on February 15th when the paper reported on Western concerns that Iran is hiding a nuclear facility deep underground to apparently elude U.N. inspectors. Quote, "The new uranium enrichment plant, known as Fordo, has raised Western concerns because it is buried deep underground, making it more impervious to scrutiny," close quote. Really? Scrutiny? That's funny because the enrichment plant at Fordo, like other Iranian nuclear facilities, is inspected, or scrutinized if you like, by the International Atomic Energy Agency, a fact that the Times seems to know since correspondent Rick Gladstone reports it a few paragraphs later. No, the real problem with Fordo is not that it's impervious to scrutiny. The problem is that it could be very difficult to bomb. As the New York Times Magazine reported on January 25th, the facility at Fordo is, quote, "in a bunker that Israeli intelligence estimates is 220 feet deep, beyond the reach of even the most advanced bunker-busting bombs possessed by the United States," close quote. It's interesting, though, how the Times indulges yet again in the practice of playing down the work of UN inspectors who, you'll remember, turned out to be right about Iraq. Elsewhere in the paper, the Times casually notes that, quote, "Iranian saber rattling is increasing the sense of instability in the Middle East," close quote.
Newsweek's February 12th cover declaring the war on Christians is intended to be provocative. The article inside is much more than that. It's poorly argued, inflammatory, and dangerous. Author Ayan Hirsi Ali claims that the West cares too much about stories of victimized Muslims. The real story, she alleges, is that, quote, "Christians are being killed in the Islamic world because of their religion. It is a rising genocide that ought to provoke global alarm," close quote. This is a remarkably serious charge. Hirsi Ali alleges that it is spread across the globe, quote, the violent oppression of Christian minorities has become the norm in Muslim-majority nations stretching from West Africa and the Middle East to South Asia and Oceania. And she claims that lobbying groups like the Council on American-Islamic Relations cover this up by pressuring the media to keep quiet about the Muslim slaughter of Christians. So not only is there a genocide, there are groups that are in effect enabling that genocide. Hirsi Ali makes this shocking, dangerous attack on a group vilified by many on the right, but offers no evidence to back it up. And what evidence is there that there is such a genocide underway? Hirsi Ali points to several incidents of terrible brutality, but that does not constitute genocide. Some of the deadliest incidents are in Egypt and Iraq, where thousands have been killed in violent terrorist attacks or at the hands of security forces. There is little evidence that these killings were religiously motivated. The real message of the piece is, as Hirsi Ali puts it, that we must stop, quote, falling for overblown tales of Western Islamophobia, close quote. To advance that specious argument, she alleges a genocide of Christians and smears an American Muslim group for covering up that genocide. Newsweek should be ashamed to print such inflammatory propaganda.
People living on the island of Okinawa overwhelmingly oppose the U.S. military base there, and even more overwhelmingly oppose plans to build a new one. Massive protests have happened for years, though you'd hardly know it from U.S. media. And yet, somehow, the New York Times has determined that they know better. Hence the February 15th headline, "Amid image of ire towards U.S. bases, Okinawans' true views vary." And those true views are apparently supportive of U.S. bases. The Times tells us that if you wander up the narrow streets of the small town where the new airfield would be built, quote, the villagers will tell you a different story, close quote. Yes, if you, quote, look more deeply, a nuanced picture emerges, close quote. Does the Times not know that the polls of people living on the island say otherwise? No, they're aware of that. It's mentioned in passing and discounted for failing to capture the apparently shallow depth of that opposition. The Times has been down this road on the Okinawa story before, but the question remains why the paper feels the need to act as boosters for U.S. base building.
And finally, fact-checking would seem to be a core component of journalism. If reporters aren't going to try and ascertain the truth of statements politicians and others make, we could all just read press releases, right? But many outlets seem to have outsourced the job of fact-checking to outfits like PolitiFact. And that's why it really matters when PolitiFact is bad at that job. Many were ready to stick a fork in the group when they declared that Republicans voted to end Medicare was the lie of the year, when it's actually, you know, true. Those critics have more fodder now based on the group's handling of Florida Senator Mark Rubio's claim that the majority of Americans are conservatives. PolitiFact cited Gallup polls showing that 40% of Americans describe themselves as conservative. That, as they noted, is not a majority. And so they declared Rubio's statement mostly true. If you don't get it, you aren't alone. Rachel Maddow called the group a disaster on her program. And the response from PolitiFact didn't help matters. We felt that while the number was short of a majority, it was still a plurality, they explained. Well, that's wildly unconvincing. It's also inconsistent. As Jameson Fosser pointed out, PolitiFact has elsewhere determined that pluralities and majorities are, you know, different. PolitiFact claims that even if you don't agree with them, quote, our research and analysis helps you sort out what's true in the political discourse, close quote. One thing that's true about the political discourse, lousy fact-checking doesn't help.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch group FAIR. FAIR also publishes a magazine called Extra. I'll be giving subscription information for Extra later on in the show. What's the takeaway from news coverage of the White House's new budget proposal? According to the New York Times, it was about raising taxes on the wealthy, as reporter Jackie Combs reported on February 13th, and cutting back on military spending, as Combs and colleague Helene Cooper wrote about on February 14th. Coverage elsewhere did not wander too far off the same script. This was as predicted by our guest, Ruth Flower. She's the legislative director for the Friends Committee on National Legislation. Her piece, Five Things Your Newspaper Might Not Tell You About the Budget, is available on the Friends website at fcnl.org. Welcome to Counterspin, Ruth Flower.
Oh, thank you.
Well, let's talk about the White House budget. One area that the coverage becomes problematic and that you focus on is military spending. What might listeners not learn about this from their local newspaper?
Well, there's been an awful lot of panic about these huge cuts in military spending, but actually it's only about half of the cuts that are required under the Budget Control Act that are being proposed right now. So we're saying that that's not enough. It's a good start. $487 billion over the next 10 years is a good start. But what the Budget Control Act actually requires is about twice that per year.
And remind listeners what the Budget Control Act is.
The Budget Control Act is a thing that was passed last August when there was a lot of worry about how the debt was piling up and that we needed to do something about the debt. And so Congress couldn't really come to any conclusion about it. So they passed this Budget Control Act that was going to have two or three stages to it to get spending and revenues perhaps under control.
So it was bipartisan. And so some of this grumbling from Republicans about, you know, they're cutting too deeply is perhaps disingenuous.
It was absolutely bipartisan. It had to be in order to pass.
Well, there are indeed some increased taxes on the wealthy, are there not?
There are.
And what should listeners beware of in reporting on tax increases, or perhaps more accurately put, revenue increases?
Revenue increases? Well, in the budget, there is a proposal to, in fact, end some of the what are called the Bush tax cuts. It's the tax cuts that were put in on a so-called temporary measure back in the early 2000s when we were in a bit of a recession then, and it was intended to stimulate the economy. But these are supposed to last 10 years, and then we've extended them. And so now the next extension is coming due in December. And the question will be for next year, do we continue these tax cuts for everyone that is affected, or do we continue them for only some people, or what? The White House has apparently looked at what is the best stimulus effect of these cuts and is opting to leave the cuts in place for the sort of moderate and lower, or maybe high moderate and lower income people, and end them for the highest income that make over $250,000 a year. There's also a couple of other things in there about the way certain kinds of income is treated, so that it's treated as regular income instead of at a lower tax rate under a state or capital gains income.
For people making over $250,000 a year,
right.
For instance, dividend income. Speaking of stimulus, progressive economists like Mark Weisbrot of the Center for Economic and Policy Research point out that while the budget does have some positive measures regarding jobs and economic growth, he doesn't see it as nearly enough in such a demand-starved economy. Weisbrot sees this as part of President Obama's overall acceptance of the right-wing narrative that sees debt and deficits as the central problem of the U.S. economy. I might add that it's a narrative that we've seen, that much of the media also seems to accept, too. Where does the Friends Committee on National Legislation weigh in on such matters?
Well, we think that the debt overall is a problem, and it's something that needs to be dealt with over the long term to get our annual deficits that we're adding to the debt down to about 3% of GDP. What we're understanding, we're not economists here, but what we're understanding from progressive economists that we follow more closely, such as the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, is that it's not so much how big the debt itself is, which is what Mark focuses on, but on how it relates to the gross domestic product. So down around 3% of gross domestic product, if that's what your deficit is year to year, that's sustainable. And we can get there in a number of ways. The question is how we get there. And Mark Weisbrot is totally correct that we need to create more demand in order to rescue the economy and get it back on its feet. Things like some of the tax breaks that have been given to small and large business and so on are not necessarily going to create that demand. We've had some of the small business people that we talk to say, look, I'm not going to hire more people until I have more customers, and I know that they're going to be coming in the door. So we do need to get money into people's pockets so that they can buy more, so that more people can be hired and so on. But in order to break that circle, you really do need direct spending on direct job creation. And again, as I'm not an economist, I don't know if what the president has in the budget is enough. It probably isn't. but he does have some direct job creation in the budget, and that's a good thing.
Well, your piece is titled Five Things Your Newspaper Might Not Tell You About the Budget. I'm wondering why you chose that title. Why would newspapers not report this?
It's just that we could kind of see that the kinds of things that people were going to pick up on right away would reflect what some of the pre-releases had been. One being the panic about how can we possibly cut the military budget so much, and the other being this idea that perhaps some taxes would be increased on the wealthiest. So we just thought that was going to be coming along. And then we looked at some of the other things that are a little bit hidden that people are not going to see, and perhaps they're not the kind of thing that makes a headline, so they're not going to be in there.
Well, I want to ask you finally, how seriously should listeners take this budget? With such a deadlocked Congress, is it too cynical to dismiss the proposal as simply a political document, as we've heard in a lot of reports?
I've worked on the budget since 1981, and almost every budget that comes in is rejected out of hand by whichever opposite party is in there as dead on arrival. This is just a political document. That's what they say every year. However, the budgets always have a tremendous impact on what Congress actually does in its appropriations and in the rest of its processes for the year, because it's the only thing out there with as much information and with as much line item detail as is in this document. So that's what the appropriations committees end up working with. They go plus or minus from there, and they argue with it, but it is the basis of their debate. The Congress has been deadlocked and may well be right on through the elections, but by the end of the year, by December 31st, they're going to have to come up with something. So we're predicting a lot of activity during the lame duck session after the elections.
We've been speaking with Ruth Flower of the Friends Committee on National Legislation. You can read her Five Things Your Newspaper Might Not Tell You About the Budget on the group's website at fcnl.org. Thanks for joining us today on Counterspin, Ruth Flower.
Thank you.
One year ago, the state of Wisconsin was the site of a massive citizen rebellion. Republican Governor Scott Walker was using what should have been a routine budget fix as a pretext to go after public sector workers. Tens of thousands took to the streets to oppose the move, and suddenly things that are rarely discussed in the corporate media became big news. So what did we learn in Wisconsin, and what did those protests tell us about how journalism and media activism have developed? John Nichols tackles that and much more in his new book, Uprising, How Wisconsin Renewed the Politics of Protest from Madison to Wall Street. We caught up with him here in New York City on his book tour. I think one of the big lessons of the book, you write it from a flagrantly biased perspective. One of the big lessons is that a story like Wisconsin can't really be told by, you know, straight arrow, stick-in-the-mud, objective, disinterested media. As you write in the book, as the protests in Wisconsin went national, the few strengths and many pathologies of major media in the United States were fully on display. How did you see that?
Well, I saw it in a lot of ways. Perhaps the most profound were the ones that we always default to, criticizing Fox, you know, criticizing Rush Limbaugh. Of course, they went to the barricades on this one. This terrified them because they had spent the better part of 3 years ginning up the fantasy that there was a mass Tea Party movement in America. Tea Party movement is real in some places. We shouldn't dismiss it, but we should recognize that an awfully lot of it is a production paid for by the Koch brothers, astroturfed, the whole bit. They looked out in Wisconsin and suddenly they saw dramatically larger events that seemed to look an awfully lot like the people they claimed were in the Tea Party, but were in fact opposing a Republican governor. So you saw, the really sort of darkest propagandistic, I wouldn't always say propaganda, but in that style of, you know, really trying to diminish those who frighten you sort of coverage. But we really have to move beyond Fox, you know, and beyond, you know, those institutions that we usually criticize to the mainstream institutions. Major media in this country has taken in the spin that nobody likes labor, mm-hmm. that nobody likes public institutions, that nobody likes teachers. And so sincere reporters who I think really wanted to try and get the story arrived with an assumption that, yes, there are these demonstrations here. There must be a lot of people out there who don't like this, who disagree with this. And they bent over backward to go find the people who weren't at the story and stumbled in horrible ways. The New York Times did one story where they thought they had found a worker in a blue-collar town south of Madison who was going to criticize all the public employees. And they ran the story on the front page. Governor Walker himself talked about it as a, you know, really evidence of what's going on. It was only a week later they corrected it. Turned out the guy had made up his whole story. And the saddest part of it was that in the interview, the guy had claimed to be part of a United Auto Workers local. If the New York Times reporters had just stayed at the Capitol in Madison, that United Auto Workers local was there en masse with their banners marching with the public sector workers. And we saw this just again and again and again. And the last thing, though, that I'd point out is one of the darker elements of major media that, as somebody who's covered media for a long time, I hadn't really thought about. You perhaps have. And that is the passionate desire to declare a protest or a movement over. And so I can't tell you the number of obituaries that were written. It was like Governor Walker signed a bill, you know, part of the bill. It's over. They didn't win every recall election in the summer. It's over. 6 months have passed. It's over. It's just obituary after obituary after obituary. And then you saw in the classic thing, major media across the country shocked when the supposedly dead, you know, creature crawled out of the crypt and filed a million recall signatures to remove the governor.
As I was reading the book, the one thing and you keep coming back to this prank phone call to Governor Walker, and I have to feel like that is maybe not the most important act of journalism in Wisconsin, but it was the most revealing because media coverage has to buy certain assumptions. There's a real fiscal crisis in this state. Labor unions on the decline. People don't like public sector workers. And this prank phone call exposed that Governor Walker had this agenda that the protesters were suggesting, if not demanding people realize, that he did have. And here it was in the form of a prank. We laid it all out.
Yeah. And remember, I came up covering quite a bit of politics in South Africa. And in the last stages of apartheid, the people of goodwill in South Africa would tune in the satirical programs because that's where they'd actually get the real news creeping out. And an immense amount came out when Ian Murphy, who is a blogger from Buffalo, New York, he calls himself the Buffalo Beast, placed a call to the governor's office. I think he was going to leave a message with an aide or a secretary that he would record and it would be kind of funny. Instead, in the midst of this crisis, by claiming that he was David Koch, one of the wealthiest men in America, he got through all of the governor's aides straight to the governor. So he finds himself on the phone. And I've interviewed Murphy about this. It's a fascinating thing. He said, I assumed I was going to be on for a minute. The governor wouldn't let me go. The governor realized he thought this was a billionaire calling, a big campaign donor. And he kept talking about everything. And so as Ian Murphy, the prank caller, threw subjects up, the governor just went into him in ways that were staggeringly revealing and unsettling. At one point, Ian Murphy, pretending to be David Koch, said, well, you should send in some thugs. You should break up the demonstrations. Use agent provocateurs to stir violence in the midst of very peaceful demonstrations where people had brought their kids, where moms were bringing disabled children to protest against cuts. Here you had this thuggish guy saying, well, throw in some people with, you know, clubs. Let's start some violence. And the governor said, oh, we thought about that. You know, but we weren't sure how it was going to play politically. So we're, you know, and it was an absolutely stunning revelation that I think got some play nationally. It got attention nationally. But in Wisconsin, it really shifted the dynamic. And of course, one of the things about journalism is it's supposed to have an impact. It's supposed to reveal things that make people rethink or look at things in a new way. And there's simply no question that that happened.
The phone call was revealing in that the coverage of Wisconsin was that the governor had to do this, that there's a budget crisis and he's making the painful but necessary steps. And media love to hear a politician who's brave enough to cut spending and really hurt working people's lives. That's the definition of political bravery. And this was a case where suddenly all of those assumptions fell down and Governor Walker is not talking about a budget tweak. He's talking about his Reagan moment where he can become a national figure and lead a new revolution. One of the most fascinating parts of the book is where we're talking about old media, new media. We've been having this discussion for at least 10 years about what kind of journalism we're going to have. You have a new theory here, and we're living it, I guess, next media. Tell us what that is.
You and I have been talking about these issues for a very long time because we've looked at media, you know, as a structural reality. And I think for a long time, we've all wrestled with this question of what happens as legacy media, old media, newspapers, radio stations, television stations, lose advertising revenue to the web and really begin to diminish themselves. They do far, far less journalism. They do it in a much more sort of celebrity, scandal-oriented rather than real deep journalism. What replaces that? But still, it was a struggle to see where do you kind of combine old school journalism with all this new technology, all these new opportunities. And in Wisconsin, the people who figured it out, and I think we probably should have them at media reform conferences. And now we're like stay at home moms doing Facebook pages, and they said, I don't really care about whether this is old media or new media. What I care about is that my community is in crisis. There is an immense struggle going on. This is the most dynamic thing maybe I've ever seen in my life, and I want to communicate information about it. So if there's a story in the New York Times that is useful, I'm going to grab that and link to it. If there's an analysis of media coverage at FAIR's website, I'm going to grab that and link to that. If there's a video by this young guy, Matt Wisniewski, that's showing some of the dynamics, I'm going to click with that video. If I heard a song, I'll put that on too. And, if there's a legislative report that came out, very dull thing, but now everybody cares about it, I'll bring that in. And maybe I'll even, set it up in a way that looks kind of nice and is appealing. And then I'll take my phone out and I'll tweet about it and get people there. And what you started to see is stuff that we all know exists. We all know all these, old, new, and all the technology exists. But the creativity with which people brought it together and the speed and the dynamism allowed things to happen that are fresh and new and very exciting. As people are figuring out how to communicate information, how to organize, how to activate with these new tools in very sophisticated ways that I think take the best of old and the best of new, put it together. And that's why I refer to it as a next media system. I think we have to sometimes draw these lines, recognize something new is developing, and embrace it because it's very, very powerful. And we shouldn't let it just sort of evolve or ooze in. We should say, hey, hold it. There's something here that's big.
John Nichols, thanks so much.
Thank you, brother. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
That was John Nichols. His book, Uprising, How Wisconsin Renewed the Politics of Protest from Madison to Wall Street, is available now from Nation Books.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch group FAIR, based in New York. FAIR also publishes a monthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call the following toll-free number, 1-800-847-3993. That's 1-800-847-3993. Or go to FAIR's website at fair.org for more information. That's also where you can listen to Counterspin and subscribe to the Counterspin podcast. This show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media and co-hosted by Peter Hart. I'm Steve Rendell. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.